This is Jim Inkster. Coming today on Talk Louisiana, we'll hear from Adam Knapp, the president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber for the last decade. He'll be talking about an appearance coming next week from Dr. David Camp. He has helped groups focus on a variety of topics, including conflict resolution. And, of course, in our community, we have some conflicts that need to be resolved. We'll talk with David Camp and with Adam Knapp about what's going on in Baton Rouge. Also, Smiley Anders, the venerable columnist for The Advocate, celebrating 39 years come Monday of writing his six-day-a-week column. Smiley will reflect on nearly four decades as one of the longest-standing and serving columnists in the country. It's been quite a ride for Smiley Gray Anders, Jr., the pride of Natchez, Mississippi. We'll talk with him. Now the news on WRKF. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar is producing, and we begin our show today with Adam Knapp, the president of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber for a decade now. Hard to believe that it's been 10 years that Adam's been speaking with us on occasion. And he is here today to talk about an event that is part of the Dialogue on Race Louisiana overture. And this is a fundraiser for Dialogue on Race next Wednesday, D-Day, June 6th. Adam Knapp will be at the Goodwood Library, as will David Camp, who is the featured speaker. And David is a man who does this for a living. He talks about conflict resolution. And as we know, in Baton Rouge, we have much healing to do, and we certainly have a lot of division in our community. Adam, before we hear from David, who is joining us telephonically from Chicago, how do you see our community right now?
You know, a lot of the folks at the Baton Rouge Area, and thank you for having me on. It's always an honor and joy to join you. A lot of the folks in our community and in our organization share with us their concern that race underlies a lot of conversations across the region. And, we know and experienced this after the Alton Sterling shooting in 2016, is that it laid bare a lot of those challenges in the community. At that moment, we actually had a committee within our organization leading a lot of work on diversity and inclusion that did call for and encourage more open conversations about race as a responsibility of the business community. And as probably a lot of the listeners know, that it almost touches everything across the community, whether it's education or crime, other facets of politics. So it's something that definitely affects all of us in the community to be engaging in.
We first began the show more than 14 years ago, and many of the same issues that were prevalent then are around now. And I occasionally hear from some folks who say they're tired of hearing about talk. They want action. There has to be some evidence that the talk is working. When will we have that evidence, or will we?
We may want to pitch that to our guest here. The conversations that a lot of us have is evidence or is born of evidence or concern that the trust that exists across the community to have this conversation is very thin, perhaps. And that's where a lot of these conversations go, is how do you reestablish a place where you can have a conversation that both parties, mm-hmm. white and black, can talk across kind of a divide of trust.
Well, and it's important for you to be a part of this because you're the majority race and you're a business guy, and a lot of times people like you, like us, we're not considered to be in the loop on this and may not even care about it. But you're saying you do care and we should care. Why?
The community... Let me just bring this to BRAC's work. The community, in engaging in this conversation, can also help build that trust that we can have conversations about other issues that allow us to talk about education, progress and change in education, dealing with community issues of deep cycles of poverty. The ability to have those conversations start with an understanding of the challenges of talking about race. We saw this on a recent canvas trip in Cincinnati 2 weeks ago. The Cincinnati Chamber, just as an example, directly engages in conversations about race and their community, similar dynamics of poverty and a black-white divide in the community. Their business community has lived in that and owned that conversation very aggressively and driven a strategy then about what it looks like to have business development programs to help elevate more economic opportunity, which has helped drive economic access in the market, which has been healthy for their overall economy.
877-217-5757 is your number. You can send us an email to talk@talklouisiana.org. Dr. David Camp, who is joining us from Chicago, has been touring the country for more than a year, bringing new conversational skills to people who desire to combat racism through more effective interpersonal conversation. His effort has been called the Ally Conversation Toolkit, or the White Ally Toolkit. Tell us about this and how this became something that you're involved with, David Camp.
Sure. Thank you so much for having me on the program. So I've been doing dialogue work about racial issues for about 25 years. Long ago, 20 years ago, for example, I was with the White House Presidents Initiative on Race with President Clinton, trying to get a national conversation going. And I've been doing this type of work and thinking about how to bring productive interracial dialogue to scale for a long time. So, and I would just say that you guys in Baton Rouge need to be very, very proud of the Dialogues on Race Louisiana. It is a leading program that uses sort of innovative models of how to do this work. And so y'all should be very proud of that you have a local resource in that regard. So it was about a year and a half ago that I recognized that one of the things that I need to expand my work to include is having people talk about race in a different way. Instead, in addition to having the important work of putting people in cross-racial dialogue groups, and that's vital, and I've been doing that for a long time, it's important to figure out how to have people talk about these issues in interpersonal conversations. So then the question becomes, what are the skills necessary for that? So as I recognized that, and I was realizing that if we're going to really move forward on racial inclusion, racial equity, we've got to reduce the number of people who think racism isn't an issue. And for that to happen, you're probably going to have – everybody can't be in a dialogue group. We probably need people talking interpersonally, but doing so in a way that's effective. Too often, people believe that racism is real. They either avoid talking to people who don't think it's real, or they attack them. And our motto is don't attack, don't avoid, but engage. And so this is all about engagement skills. Have an effective conversation.
What's the biggest misunderstanding when it comes to discussions about race?
The biggest misunderstanding among people who think that racism is real, and that's about half the American public, the biggest misunderstanding is they think that the way to be influential over people who don't think it's real is to berate them with facts and moral arguments about how they're just wrong and morally problematic. When that's the biggest misunderstanding. What we try to teach is a different way of engaging people to say, let's shift the conversation to what's your experiences around these issues, what's my experience. So we try to shift people in terms of how they handle themselves in these kind of conversations, so that the conversations are more effective. And this shift is based on principles from neurobiology, persuasion science, and conflict resolution, that a way to have a more effective conversation is to talk about experiences, not facts or some sense of moral obligation. And that can produce more connectivity and more progress.
Have you seen people change? You know, sometimes people learn to talk the talk, but very often they don't learn how to walk the walk. Do people really change when they are exposed to interacting with people of other races?
Well, sure. I mean, it is well known. So I just want to clarify. You said people of other races. So yes, it is clear that contact between people of different races produces different outcomes. In fact, that theory is called contact theory, and that's been known for 40, 50 years. In fact, it turns out that people just even knowing that somebody who is in the same race as them has had productive interaction with somebody of a different race. Like, you know, if for example, Adam, if you were somebody who didn't have that much contact with people of color, and then Adam tells you a story about such a contact, that affects your attitude. That's called extended contact theory. So I just want to so first of all, we know that that's true, but moreover, to your question, we get reports all the time about people using the strategies, the conversational strategies that we recommend in this project. And people talk about having a much more effective conversation with their family members, with their neighbors, with people that, with strangers, because we're looking for an interaction style that's less about combat and name calling and argument, and more about experience sharing, and thus that can produce the forward motion. So we've been told a bunch of times that these strategies are more effective.
Yeah, I think let me build on that too. I think what a number of us, we had a chance to meet David a couple of years ago, actually at a conference, and thrilled to have him come into Baton Rouge next week to speak on June 6th. For those who want to hear David, the event is June 6th at 5 p.m. at the Goodwood Library. What is interesting about David, what you're saying is conversations are something that we all are doing, and it's a very simple part of the work of helping folks gain understanding and be open to understanding. And what I find just in my own experience is that the challenge for a lot of white folks, let me kind of speak only about myself here, is that it feels like a threatening conversation that you're having if you start to engage in the conversation about race and you worry about being, you know, trapped or somebody taking your words out of context. And that's where you can start to use these conversations as tools to do this without being threatened.
877-217-5757 is your number, 297-5633 locally. The email's talk@talklouisiana.org. We're back after this brief pause. This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Smiley Gray Anders is with us. He was born in Natchez, Mississippi, November 20, 1937. Moved to Baton Rouge in 1946, and he's been here most of the time since, graduate of Estruma High and LSU, and for the last 39 years, as of Monday, this coming Monday, June 4th, Smiley has written a six-day-a-week column for The Advocate. His items column was a national winner every year, and it was the Herb Kane competition.
Award, yeah.
And he won it so many times that they quit giving away the award because it became the Smiley Anders Award. But he is certainly a staple in our community. I promoted you as the venerable Smiley Anders, and Lanny Keller says it should be the venerated Smiley Anders.
Yeah, venerated, right? I think is a little better. That's obviously the word you meant anyhow.
Yeah, Well, Smiley is strong stuff, and it is amazing that when The Advocate 5 years ago went to New Orleans on a daily basis, you've picked up a whole new audience.
Yeah, that just gave me a new lease on life. I pretty much doubled my contributors base. And, you know, I have a lot of regulars, and I have those who just, you know, contact me maybe once a year or something, or once, you know, altogether. But, it's been really nice. The people there are just as weird as the one up here, I discovered. So maybe weirder. But,
well, I noted that you've been doing this 39 years. And when you started, you wondered whether they were demoting you, didn't you?
Yeah, I was doing business news. I was the first full-time business writer of The Advocate hired in 73. And so for 6 years, I'd been just happily writing about business, and I figured that was going to be my career. And then one of the editors asked me to try this column so we get up more readers' names in the paper without them having to die or hold up a convenience store to get in the paper. So I tried. It was going to be an experiment.
And the experiment is now almost four decades long.
Yeah, so...
And you've got to be one of the longest-serving columnists of any kind in the world today.
Probably. I just heard from Bernard Corrette over at the Point Coupee Banner in New Roads. He's been doing his column 51 years. So I've got a ways to go to catch up with Bernard.
But for a paper of its size, I don't know of anybody in the country who has outlasted one Smiley Gray Anders Jr., and we noted that the community has evolved, as have others, and you came here in 1946, much different town now than it was then.
Oh, absolutely. I can't believe how small it was at that time. I remember the Florida Street Extension, they called it, which was from North Foster out to the traffic circle, was considered way
out of town.
If you went out to the traffic circle, you were like way out of town.
So, and now that's the middle of the city.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you went to Estruma High School.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of your classmates was none other than Billy Ab Cannon.
Billy Cannon. I sat behind him in American history class, and I have to admit, I copied off of him sometimes. He was a very bright kid.
They didn't call him Dr. Cannon for nothing.
But, that's right.
But he let you copy off him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He knew I was doing it.
Well, he died on the 20th day of May, appropriately number 20. And, and you were there with him at Estruma and there with him at LSU. And we've noted before that when he had that 89-yard punt return, Halloween 1959 to beat Ole Miss, Smiley Anders was not that far away.
I was on the sidelines. As a matter of fact, he ran down the east side, and I was spotting for a UPI photographer. That was United Press International, which was a wire service that competed with Associated Press, and they hired students to spot, and in other words, to make sure they had the right jersey numbers and yardage numbers and all that. So I was there with the photographer, and here he comes. He couldn't have been more than maybe 10 feet away when he ran down the sidelines.
And he kept on running and running.
It's quite a thrill. I forgot about my job, and I just started yelling, "Oh, Billy, go!" So very unprofessional.
Well, that play is cemented in Tiger lore as the greatest of them all, and there have been some great ones. And Billy Cannon, as we know, had more ups and downs in his life than four or five people usually do, and tremendous highs and dramatic lows. And the low of the lows came 35 years ago this summer when he was busted for counterfeiting. He served about 3 years in a federal penitentiary, but we played the cut the other day. I interviewed him a few years ago, and I asked him why he had been spared dementia, and he said he had not had any real issues, even though he had had concussions. Once was knocked out for 20 minutes, but he said, "Every now and then I have this uncontrollable urge to print money."
Oh, yeah. He accepted his punishment and went through it and was not – never tried to hide it. From anybody. He talked about it pretty frankly.
And in his time, as we have noted, he was an athlete that was supreme. He may have been the greatest athlete in the world when he was playing at Louisiana State University. What he could do as far as his speed, which was world-class, and his strength, which was world-class. Right. And he was not an inordinately huge man. He was about 6'1" and 205 pounds.
Yeah, and he was bow-legged, too, if you've ever seen.
Yeah, a lot of great runners. So was O.J. Simpson.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And I once compared Billy to O.J., and he didn't like that too much. But
O.J. got in a bit of trouble, too.
He did, and they both won the Heisman, and they both got in trouble at 46. Yeah, yeah. And I could go on and on about the similarities. But Billy, I think, and I got to know him fairly well, I think he was a decent fellow who made a terrible mistake and owned up to it. O.J., great athlete, but not a great man and not a good man.
No,
he's a very bad man, and he's not so tough without a knife. Billy was a tough guy.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, he came from a real tough area of Baton Rouge at the time, and a lot of the kids there did get in trouble.
And he got in trouble, too.
Huh?
He got in trouble as well.
Oh, yeah, right, in high school.
Yeah, and ultimately he came to Louisiana State University, and he left an impression like nobody else. His son went off to Texas A&M, though, and that was a bit of a disappointment. But Billy Jr., of course, imagine being Billy Cannon's son.
Yeah.
And living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. Talk about a burden. Oh, he was a great athlete.
He was a baseball player as well as football.
And he returned a punt 89 yards for Broadmoor to beat Estruma on Halloween of 1979.
I didn't realize
yeah,
that.
Yeah, right after you started writing your column. June 4th, 1979, Smiley Anders started this. And if you'd like to talk with this fine gentleman, who probably will go on for another 39 years, 877-217-5757, Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana. Henry, good morning. You're on with Smiley.
Well, good morning, Mr. Jim, and good morning, Mr. Smiley. Mr. Jim, I think that you've broken some news today.
Yes, in what
way? We understand now that Mr. Smiley got his start in life copying answers off of Billy Cannon's history test. And now that that's been determined and we know that Smiley has made a 39-year career out of copying and pasting, I think we need to give credit to the great Billy Cannon for giving Smiley his start.
Absolutely, absolutely. I owe it all to Billy.
Well, Henry, thanks for putting it in perspective. Smiley, though, was not a bad student himself. He was editor of the Reveille.
Yeah, it was. That was fun.
Now, Ross Dellinger, the sports writer for The Advocate, who I understand is moving to Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
Nice move for him, and congratulations to Ross. He's writing a book about the Ole Miss rivalry, at least part of a book. And he asked me who might know about the intensity of that rivalry when it was really in its heyday, and I said, you need to talk to Smiley Anders.
Oh, yeah.
It was a bitter, bloody...
He called me. Yeah, well, they were... of course, the reason is that they were so evenly matched. They would win one year, we'd win one year, so it was like...
And every game was played in Baton Rouge.
Right, it seemed like, yeah. So
almost every game.
So they, it was really something. We really wanted to beat them bad. So.
But they dropped flyers on the LSU campus.
Yeah.
And Johnny Vaught, the coach for Ole Miss, he said, I thought Dietzel's flying days were over, talking about Paul Dietzel. And Ole Miss was the rival. And Billy Cannon was a native of Philadelphia, Mississippi. Yeah. Smiley, a native of Natchez, Mississippi. There were connections between the two states. And John McGinnis, in his book, The Last Hayride, he said the dead giveaway on Cannon's counterfeiting was that when you look closely, instead of In God We Trust, it said, Go to Hell, Ole Miss. But... Ole Miss, in that 1959 team, which lost on the run by Billy Cannon and the goal line stand by Billy Cannon and Warren Rabb, that team outscored its opponents 350-21, only allowed three touchdowns all season, and one of those was the Cannon run. So it may have been the greatest SEC team of all time, and it lost in Tiger Stadium to the great Billy Ab Cannon. And Smiley... you've known a lot of characters through the years. Who's the most vivid character you've covered in your career?
Oh, gee, that's really hard to say. The most vivid. I've had a chance to meet some really great writers, and probably the best humor writer I've ever met was Dave Barry, who I really missed the column he did on the op-ed page of The Advocate. Well, everywhere. He was widely syndicated. And he signed a book for me. I was at a conference of writers. And I got him to sign it to Smiley Anders, friend, mentor, role model, lover. So he said, enjoy doing it. He had a great sense of humor. I've also met Calvin Trillin.
Okay, hold tight. Former guest on this show. We're back after this pause with more Smiley Anders. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Ali Baltazar producing. Your numbers 877-217-5757. David Camp, who's been touring the country, bringing new conversational skills to interpersonal conversations about race. He will be here in Baton Rouge next Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Goodwood Library. And this is a fundraiser for Dialogues on Race Louisiana. And Adam Knapp of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber, the president of BRAC for the last 10 years, he is putting the full credit of the Baton Rouge Area Chamber behind this endeavor. 877-217-5757 is your number. And Adam, in our community, we have about, what is about 50-50 in the city, I guess, black people, white people in the parish, and yet many never interact with one another. We live in largely a segregated city. You and I live in the same neighborhood, and there are some people of all races, but that's not the norm in Baton Rouge.
You know, I want to push back a little bit on that characterization. I would actually say that probably more than we recognize, we are having these cross-racial experiences in the community, whether it's at our churches, at sporting events, Little
churches.
League, T-balls.
Churches are largely segregated.
In some senses, but a lot of the larger churches actually are very well integrated or have quite a significant amount of integration. And what happens, though, is that within our friend circles, perhaps we don't challenge ourselves across these conversations because they are so difficult to have. And that's part of what this event next week is helping to create, is a set of tools for which to have this conversation with others.
Well, about a mile away from you, where you and I live, is the LSU sorority and fraternity system, largely segregated,
true,
almost 100% black or white, depending on which organization we're talking about. One of the major country clubs in our city still does not allow African-American members. Is the chamber going to talk about these things?
You know, I think that they should. I mean, we all should be having these conversations. I think that a lot of the institutions are open to that change, and part of this is also friends who want to kind of go together to be a part of different organizations. And that's where these conversations begin to create new friend circles, too.
Well, David Camp has mentioned he's in Chicago, but he travels the country. And, David, do you find that racial discussions are different in some parts of the country as opposed to others?
Sure. There's significant differences. So, you know, I've been doing going to various places to do this work, you know, Portland, Seattle, Omaha, Vermont, you know, it's all over. And as you know, in some places, there's so much isolation. You know, I've done programs, for example, in Vermont and Portland, and Vermont and Seattle, especially Portland and Seattle, that are overwhelmingly white communities. And so there's a certain way in which people are hungry for, like, what can I do? Just to be clear, nationally, what we know is that 55% of white folks believe that racism isn't really a thing. It's not really a problem. And 45% think differently. So just to be clear, this workshop is, and there's a division among black people too, but it's more like 20 to 80. So what this whole skill building workshop is about is how, if you're somebody who thinks that racism is a problem that we all need to talk about more effectively and it holds our nation back, how do you have effective conversations with those who don't think that? And without avoiding talking to them or without attacking them, to try to really have a real conversation in private setting. So that's a skill building thing. So I just want to clarify, I'm going to say a lot at the Courageous Conversation setting, but it's a skill building thing. What we're trying to do is to have people have people not just look at their shoes if somebody says something that's problematic. For example, you just talked about a couple of institutions in your community which are segregated. There are people who are bugged by that, but other people who are not. But the people who are bugged by it don't know how to talk to effectively the people who are not bugged by it to say, let's really talk about this issue in a way that makes nobody feel attacked or demeaned.
All right, David in Atlanta. Hi, David. You're on with Adam Knapp and David Camp. Good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. Paul Krugman writes in the New York Times today that the Virginia legislature just approved the expanded Medicaid under Obamacare.
Okay, now we were talking about race right now.
Well, I'm coming to race.
Go ahead. Okay.
Paul Krugman writes that the Republicans will make a new effort this year to kill Medicare in the Congress because many people perceive it to be a program that disproportionately benefits African-American people. That's the backbone of the Republican Party. You know, James Gill wrote about Bobby Jindal trying to solve poverty in Louisiana by killing poor people. And again, the perception is most poor people are black. And again, that's the backbone of the Republican Party, essentially to kill black people.
All right. Well, leaving the politics aside, there is a perception by some that poor people are black, and white people are usually not poor. Adam, as you know, that would be a grave misconception, but it's one that I'm sure is prevalent, that it's the poor black people who are getting the government benefits, and it's the working white people who are paying the freight. That's the perception some people have. How do we get past that?
Well, that's where I think this conversation coming up next week is a part of helping to bring us together in this conversation in a way that is funny. In many ways, what David does is enlightening, but engaging and funny in how he goes through his process of discussion. But part of that is to help us have that conversation, Jim. And if you're going to get to issues of economic development, economic access, employment opportunity, a lot of the things that are a part of that conversation start with having these conversations across economic classes, but also across racial groups.
877-217-5757. A few more minutes with our friend Adam Knapp and David Camp, who will be here next Wednesday, June 6, 5 p.m., Goodwood Library. Brian Breen writes, I've been through dialogue on race, Louisiana. I consider myself to be woke, but how can I discuss this with my, as he says, racist Trump-loving family members? Now, let's let David handle this one. Donald Trump, in his life, by the way, has had associations with many African Americans. So in this case, his personal experience has not been a segregated one. But there are those who are supportive of him, as we saw in Charlottesville, Virginia, who definitely are not very good people. So tell us what we can do as far as dealing with people who sometimes are not subject to reason.
Well, that's a really great question. I think that it's I do not want to characterize people who look at the world differently than me as not subject to reason. So I get what your point, though. I think that the critical thing that we teach that we will talk about and actually practice in this workshop is, if you're dealing with somebody who looks at race very differently, how do you shift the conversation from an argument about opinions to a sharing of experiences? So you can think of it as everybody has experiences, you know, that they think justify their position.
Ann on Bluebonnet. Ann, good morning. You're on with David and with Adam. Hi, Ann.
Good morning. I was calling to ask if any of the leaders of the St. George separation movement have been invited to this workshop.
All right. Will the St. George people be there?
Well, we hope all of Baton Rouge Metro will be interested in coming. Part of the goal of being on the radio and having David join is to get the word out about the event. That's June 6th, next week, 5 p.m. at the Goodwood Library. And I think this is the part and parcel of your question is...
Well, what about BRAC's position on St. George?
So we came out in opposition to it, as the media have covered in the last few weeks. I think that our comments about this have been more about the position it puts the community in on a sort of governance of the city parish. And go look at our website. We've got some information about that. But let me say, I think this conversation is a different one today. This is one about how all of us, wherever we live in our community, who want to be a part of the conversation, are given a set of tools to have these conversations. And our community is more diverse than we think about on a daily basis for most of us in the community, I think.
Well, we have come a long way, and our next guest is Smiley Anders, who can tell us how things used to be, and things have improved, but we do have a long way to go. And come Wednesday, June 6th, 5 p.m., David Camp and Adam Knapp will be at the Goodwood Library, and it'll be a fundraiser for Dialogues on Race Louisiana. Thank you, Adam. Thank you, David.
Appreciate
We're back.
You having us.
This is Jim Inkster. Pleased to have you with us for Talk Louisiana. Smiley Gray Anders is with us. He was born in Natchez, Mississippi, November 20, 1937. Moved to Baton Rouge in 1946, and he's been here most of the time since. Graduate of Estruma High and LSU, and for the last 39 years, as of Monday, this coming Monday, June 4th, Smiley has written a six-day-a-week column for The Advocate. His items column was a national winner every year, and it was the Herb Cain competition.
Award, yeah.
And he won it so many times that they quit giving away the award because it became the Smiley Anders Award. But he is certainly a staple in our community. I promoted you as the venerable Smiley Anders, and Lanny Keller says it should be the venerated Smiley Anders.
Yeah, venerated, Anders, right? I think, is a little better. That's obviously the word you meant anyhow.
Yeah, so, yeah. Right. Well, Smiley is strong stuff, and it is amazing that when the Advocate 5 years ago went to New Orleans on a daily basis, you've picked up a whole new audience.
Yeah, that just gave me a new lease on life. I pretty much doubled my contributors base. And, you know, I have a lot of regulars, and I have those who just, you know, contact me maybe once a year or something, or once, you know, altogether. But, yeah, it's been really nice. The people there are just as weird as the one up here, I discovered. So maybe weirder. But,
I noted that you've been doing this 39 years, and when you started, you wondered whether they were demoting you, didn't you?
Yeah, I was doing business news. I was the first full-time business writer the Advocate hired, and in 73. And so for 6 years, I'd been just happily writing about business, and I figured that was going to be my career. And then one of the editors asked me to try this column so we get up more readers' names in the paper without them having to die or hold up a convenience store to get in the paper. So I tried. It was going to be an experiment.
And the experiment is now almost four decades long.
Yeah, so...
And you've got to be one of the longest-serving columnists of any kind in the world today.
Probably. I just heard from Bernard Corrette over at the Point Coupee banner in New Roads. He's been doing his column 51 years. So I've got a ways to go to catch up with Bernard.
But for a paper of its size, I don't know of anybody in the country who has outlasted one Smiley Gray Anders Jr., and we noted that the community has evolved, as have others, and you came here in 1946. Much different town now than it was then.
Oh, absolutely. I can't believe how small it was at that time. I remember the Foster Street Extension, they called it, which was from North Foster out to the traffic circle, was considered way
out of town.
If you went out to the traffic circle, you were like way out of town.
So, and now that's the middle of the city.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And you went to Estruma High School.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
One of your classmates was none other than Billy Ab Cannon.
Billy Cannon. I sat behind him in American history class, and I have to admit, I copied off of him sometimes. He was a very bright kid.
They didn't call him Dr. Cannon for nothing.
That's right.
But he let you copy off him.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. He knew I was doing it.
Well, he died on the 20th day of May, appropriately number 20, and you were there with him at Estruma and there with him at LSU, and we've noted before that when he had that 89-yard punt return, Halloween 1959, to beat Ole Miss, Smiley Anders was not that far away.
I was on the sidelines. As a matter of fact, he ran down the east side, and which was I was there. I was spotting for a UPI photographer. That was United Press International, which was a wire service that competed with Associated Press, and they hired students to spot, and in other words, to make sure they had the right jersey numbers and yardage numbers and all that. So I was there with the photographer, and here he comes. He couldn't have been more than maybe 10 feet away when he ran down the sidelines.
And he kept on running and running.
It's quite a thrill. I forgot about my job, and I just started yelling, "Oh, Billy, go!" So very unprofessional.
Well, that play is cemented in Tiger lore as the greatest of them all, and there have been some great ones. And Billy Cannon, as we know, had more ups and downs in his life than four or five people usually do, and tremendous highs and dramatic lows, and the low of the lows came 35 years ago this summer when he was busted for counterfeiting. He served about 3 years in a federal penitentiary, but we played the cut the other day. I interviewed him a few years ago, and I asked him why he had been spared dementia, and he said He said he had not had any real issues, even though he had had concussions. Once was knocked out for 20 minutes, but he said, every now and then I have this uncontrollable urge to print money.
Oh, yeah. He accepted his punishment and went through it and was not, never tried to hide it, from anybody. He talked about it pretty frankly.
And in his time, as we have noted, he was an athlete that was supreme. He may have been the greatest athlete in the world when he was playing at Louisiana State University. What he could do as far as his speed, which was world-class, yeah, and his strength, which was world-class. Yeah. And he was not an inordinately huge man. He was about 6'1" and 205 pounds.
Yeah, and he was bow-legged, too, if you've ever seen.
Yeah, a lot of great runners. So was O.J. Simpson.
Oh, really?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. And I once compared Billy to O.J., and he didn't like that too much. But
O.J. got in a bit of trouble, too.
He did, and they both won the Heisman, and they both got in trouble at 46. Yeah, right. And I could go on and on about the similarities. But Billy, I think, and I got to know him fairly well, I think he was a decent fellow who made a terrible mistake and owned up to it. O.J., great athlete, but not a great man and not a good man.
No,
he's a very bad man, and he's not so tough without a knife. Billy was a tough guy.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Well, he came from a real tough area of Baton Rouge at the time, and a lot of the kids there did get in trouble.
And he got in trouble, too.
Huh?
He got in trouble as well.
Oh, yeah, right, in high school.
Yeah, and ultimately he came to Louisiana State University, and he left an impression like nobody else. His son went off to Texas A&M, though, and that was a bit of a disappointment. But Billy Jr., of course, imagine being Billy Cannon's son.
Yeah.
And living in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
He was
about
a
burden.
Athlete.
Oh, he was a great athlete.
He was a baseball player as well as football.
And he returned a punt 89 yards for Broadmoor to beat Estruma on Halloween of 1979.
I didn't realize
that. Yeah, right after you started writing your column. June 4th, 1979, wow. Smiley Anders started this. And if you'd like to talk with this fine gentleman, who probably will go on for another 39 years, 877-217-5757, Henry at the Country Club of Louisiana. Henry, good morning. You're on with Smiley.
Well, good morning, Mr. Jim, and good morning, Mr. Smiley. Mr. Jim, I think that you've broken some news today.
Yes, in what
way? We understand now that Mr. Smiley got his start in life copying answers off of Billy Cannon's history test.
Nice.
And now that that's been determined and we know that Smiley has made a 39-year career out of copying and pasting, I think we need to give credit to the great Billy Cannon for giving Smiley his start.
Absolutely, absolutely. I owe it all to Billy.
Well, Henry, thanks for putting it in perspective. Smiley, though, was not a bad student himself. He was editor of the Reveille.
Yeah, it was. That was fun.
Now, Ross Dellinger, the sports writer for The Advocate, who I understand is moving to Sports Illustrated.
Yeah.
Nice move for him, and congratulations to Ross. He's writing a book about the Ole Miss rivalry, at least part of a book. And he asked me who might know about the intensity of that rivalry when it was really in its heyday, and I said, you need to talk to Smiley Anders.
Oh, yeah.
It was a bitter, bloody...
He called me. Yeah, well, they were... of course, the reason is that they were so evenly matched. They would win one year, we'd win one year, so it was like...
And every game was played in Baton Rouge.
Right, it seemed like, yeah. So
almost every game.
So they, it was really something. We really wanted to beat them bad. So.
But they dropped flyers on the LSU campus. And Johnny Vaught, the coach for Ole Miss, he said, I thought Dietzel's flying days were over, talking about Paul Dietzel. And Ole Miss was the rival. And Billy Cannon was a native of Philadelphia, Mississippi.
Yeah.
Smiley, a native of Natchez, Mississippi. There were connections between the two states. And John McGinnis, in his book, The Last Hayride, he said the dead giveaway on Cannon's counterfeiting was that when you look closely, instead of In God We Trust, it said, Go to Hell, Ole Miss. But... Ole Miss, in that 1959 team, which lost on the run by Billy Cannon and the goal line stand by Billy Cannon and Warren Ram, That team outscored its opponents 350-21, only allowed three touchdowns all season, and one of those was the cannon run. So it may have been the greatest SEC team of all time, and it lost in Tiger Stadium to the great Billy Ab Cannon. And Smiley, you've known a lot of characters through the years. Who's the most vivid character you've covered in your career?
Oh, gee, that's really hard to say. The most vivid. I've had a chance to meet some really great writers, and probably the best humor writer I've ever met was Dave Barry, who just I really miss the column he did on the op-ed page of the Advocate. Well, everywhere he was widely syndicated, and he signed a book for me. I was at a conference of writers, and I got him to sign it to Smiley Anders, friend, mentor, role model, lover. So, he said,
from Dave Barry.
Doing it. He had a great sense of humor. He's probably I've also met Calvin Trillin.
Okay, hold tight. Former guest on this show. We're back after this pause with more Smiley Anders.